Hello and welcome to the This Month in Forensics podcast for July 2018. I'm Phil Moore and here's a few things from the last month that I wanted to talk about. Of course, this isn't everything. The industry puts out a massive amount of content every week, so for everything that I can find, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. Okay, so there were a lot of tools updated this month, but I wanted to just point out a few of the triage tools and scripts that people have been putting out that I thought looked quite interesting. Starting with Jamie Levy releasing MemTriage, which allows you to quickly query a live Windows machine for RAM artifacts. And the tool utilizes WinPMem to access physical memory and then volatility for analysis. As people would know, Jamie is one of the authors of The Art of Memory Forensics, as well as a core developer of volatility. So she definitely knows what she's doing. Over at SpectreOps, they have released a new series of tools called Ghostpack, and these tools look like they have a lot of useful functionality, from triaging an incident to determining insecurities on a system and dumping specific process memory, among many other things that they can do. So it's something to check out if you might find it useful to run during engagement. Matthew May released a triage tool called F-Triage, which is a framework for automating forensic data acquisition, reduction, and overall triage. And this looks like it'll work well on the Linux-based SIF workstation, allow you to quickly run the scripts that you might otherwise be manually running. And lastly, to round out the triage tools of the month, Mike Carey released a PowerShell script that automates the use of Eric Zimmerman's command line tools. It's probably one of my favorites, I guess, that I've played with in the last month, because it's something that was on my list of things to write, and thankfully Mike did it so I don't have to. And I really like the concept because Eric's tools are really good, as everyone knows, and if you haven't played with them, go play with them. The steps for loading up the data could be performed programmatically, and that's what Mike's done, so that you can just point it at a mounted image and say, here's Eric's tools, here's the image, pipe out all the data somewhere, and then it just allows you to really quickly get at the analysis examination stage rather than just kind of setting up your data output pretty much. All right, Adam Harrison at 123-4N6 answered a few of the Sunday Funday challenges, which we will talk about a bit later, but this one was about expat timestamps and time zones. So outside of the many rabbit holes that it looks like Adam went down, the summary result was that no tools will reliably display the expat timestamps associated with the various tested operating systems that he ran through, which is great, I guess. And it's something that might be in one of those too hard basket problems where people just rely on what the tools are telling them. But hopefully Adam can expand on his research a bit in the future, and we'll see how that goes. Paul Bryant actually ended up winning that Sunday Funday challenge, and there's a link to his answer in the show notes. The big talk of last month, actually, I probably buried the lead a bit, was the Activities API on O365, and shortly after the disclosure of that API, Microsoft closed it off. Whether they were going to already, or whether the release of the CrowdStrike module, for example, or the anonymous style video, and all the conversations that came out of that, Microsoft might have decided, no, it's time that we pull a pin on this. So there was a lot of discussion about whether people should have been sharing these kinds of finds, because companies might close them off, and we've seen similar things with disclosing password bypasses or physical acquisition methods on mobile devices, for example. By disclosing this information, you run the risk of that R&D time and effort, as well as the capability just disappearing. So it becomes a bit of a minefield when trying to determine the ethics surrounding sharing certain information publicly. That being said, there is still plenty of information that can be shared publicly that runs a far lower risk of a vendor caring about, which usually comes down to parsing data that is required to keep the product functioning as intended. They can, you know, make it harder in some instances, but you know, for some of this stuff, we've seen it exist for a long time after we shared the analysis concepts or the data parsing methodology. I'll put a link to Dave Cohen's thoughts on the show notes, and thankfully Dave and Adam came to the rescue again with the Sunday Funday challenge on some of your options when investigating an O365 breach with and without logging turned on. But the good news is that Microsoft actually has I think, I'm not sure if it's from when they release the post or some point in the future, they're turning audit logging on for O365 clients by default, and they're also intending on planning some adding some additional granularity that what some people were using the Activities API for. They will add some of that information back in, because a lot of people are finding a lot of useful information in that. And someone told me that by closing that off, people are going to have to start reporting the breach of an entire mailbox instead of, 12 emails, for example. So it is, I guess, in incident responders and a lot of companies' interest, and hopefully Microsoft's interest as well, to provide a little bit of that granularity back so that people can accurately portray what happened on a system rather than say, well, there's not any logging to identify what happened, so I'm just going to have to tell you everything's gone. There was also a SANS webinar by Matt Bromley, which I haven't watched, on O365 compromises, but if you do deal with business email compromise, it's probably recommended that you do. Speaking of companies closing off security vulnerabilities, Apple released iOS 11.4.1, which came with USB restricted mode. I think there was a bit of discussion about whether that was going to come in iOS 12, but Apple looks like that, even though they had it in betas for 11.2 and 3, that they decided that 11.4.1 was going to be the one that they pushed it out on. Elcomsoft and Magnet both produced some useful information with regards to ensuring that as long as you get to the device within that first hour, you're able to prevent it from disabling that USB port. And there's a lot of different devices that you're able to plug in and out. I think you have to, as long as you get it in the first hour, then the timer lasts for 5 or 6 days, might be up to a week, and then you have to unplug it and replug it in before that time, and then it will stay on indefinitely, apparently. I haven't tested this, I haven't really played around with any of it, but it's probably, if you deal with that potential problem going forward, it's probably a good idea to get quite familiar. Magnet also released a white paper on acquiring parsing iOS 11 devices, which I haven't read, but it's on my reading list because iOS devices are fairly prevalent, as we all know. Martin Corman and, I'm sorry, Hedar, I'm going to screw up your name, Hedar Yudovich, have written a post covering the startup info.xml file, which can be used to identify which processes are launched at boot. And it's great because they've started a new blog, which we'll be all following closely. Another person that started a new blog was Maxim Suhanov, who some people might remember from, he was on the Forensic Lunch recently, and he's written a registry parsing utility called YARP. He wrote a post showing the effects of different mounting mechanisms used in Paladin version 6.09 and also version 7.04, specifically with regards to mounting dirty ext4 drives, and also showed some of the instances where Debian-based operating systems like Kali can modify data on the underlying devices. Lastly, he showed that the NTFS log file may be wiped due to a bug in BusyBox, which means that the drive will be temporarily mounted as read-write. And it affects, I think this affects Paladin 6.09. I'm not 100% sure about the latest version, which is 7.04, as I said before. But I think the point that Maxim was making was that the 6.09 version was the NIST validated one. And so if people are relying on that, and that's actually writing data, then that might need to be revised. So it's good that he pointed that out. There was also a new scenario posted on the Digital Corpora website, and the scenario was created by a JMU student and covers a fictional investigation of the planning of a mass shooting. So it's another set of artifacts that you're able to pull down and test all your tools with, or just practice your analysis, which is always good. Dave Cohen listed some information about copying directories on Windows 10. So he said that if you look at the jump list with an app ID that is listed, but it looks like I've deleted from my notes. If you go to the blog post, you'll have it there. You can see an entry for every directory that has been pasted. So you don't get the source location, but rather the destination, which Dave thinks is more useful. And the MRU date associated with the the creation time of the directory will show you when that happened. And I think I saw today that Dave posted some additional testing that he was doing as part of his daily vlogging, which is good because Microsoft, I don't think, has ever really provided us a lot of useful information with regards to copying and pasting directories and files. So this is only directories, but you know, it's good to see that that's there. And because this is apparently the Adam and Dave show, Adam Harrison answered Dave's Sunday Funday challenge on identifying historical time zone configuration changes, and goes well beyond just looking at event logs and registry keys. I think he covered email and he mentioned the XFAT stuff, which was at the beginning of this show. And if you haven't noticed a theme here, the more that you share, the more likely that your name gets mentioned, which leads quite nicely into what I apparently always finish the show with, which is about sharing information. So Brett at DFIR Training wrote a short post about, he was showing off a graph pretty much about the faster the information being disseminated, the faster it disappears. So if information is tweeted out, for example, then it's probably gone. It's very hard to refer back to. And documenting your research in a more solid form, a blog post, an article, a journal article, a book, you know, all varying degrees of difficulty, allows it to be longer lasting. And that, you know, ultimately is more helpful to you, and it's more helpful to everyone else that might come across it. It's very hard to come across a tweet of useful information. Dave also gave a bit of insight into why he started his daily blogging, to point out that it wasn't really about the daily posting, but more about encouraging himself to learn more a little bit each day. And a lot of other blog authors said that they received the same benefit, and it's pretty much why I do what I do, because it forces me to read everything that I can find and write a little bit so that I can come back and refer back to it. And daily blogging isn't for everyone. It's a goal that you can set to work towards, but as other people have found, it's very hard to keep up. But once a month, I think, is actually quite reasonable. That's only 12 posts a year, and it's not that difficult to think of 12 things you can post about. If it's validating something you already know, validating something someone else knows, saying, "I've noticed this thing, does anyone else see what that is, or can anyone else help me try to figure it out?" I mean, it can go in a blog post. There's no reason why it can't. Also, Jess at Magnet shared her thoughts on giving back to the community with regards to a little bit about the blogging and the sharing of information, but also about sharing with the community and giving back to the greater community based on our skills as practitioners in digital forensics and cybersecurity. And yeah, I mean, all this sharing and encouraging people to give back and doing it's great, and ultimately it makes everything a little bit easier for everyone else, and it makes your life a little bit better with regards to having a body of work to go back to in the future. And so I wrote my thoughts down on my ThinkDFIR page about why I think you should get into, you know, documenting your findings and spending a little bit of time doing that. The TLDR is basically, it's worth putting your experiences and your testing and anything out there on your own site, because that's your brand, your little home on the web, where you can say, "I know what I know about the thing that I've tested. I know this. I don't know everything, but I know everything between point A and point B that I could find. And if someone else can help expand that, great." And ultimately, it'll benefit you in the long run. I've told other people, you don't have to do it with your name attached to it. I know a lot of people that didn't attach their name to it, and they still get a lot of the benefits from doing it. They definitely get the benefits of formalizing their learning and showing their learning in some way. And, you know, some of us just obviously like spending our weekends reading up about this and writing up about this and testing and playing around. I've also written a short page I've attached to the top of This Week in Forensics about tips on actually starting a site or a blog. But if anyone wants to talk about it a bit more, they can get in touch. It's fairly easy to find me. And that's pretty much it for the last month. Of course, this isn't everything. For everything that I found, as I mentioned at the beginning, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. Quick shout out to my Patreon and I guess PayPal donors as well. For those that have gotten a little bit of value out of the work that I've produced and wanted to give it a little bit of value back, the link is in the post. Thank you to everyone who's already done so. The Patreon supporters, for those that don't know, they get the links that I've mentioned, which makes it a little bit easier to go back to read the articles, which obviously I guess I recommend as I've mentioned them, as well as the time codes for an easy lookup. And yeah, thanks again. I really appreciate the donations and support. If you've got any suggestions or recommendations, you can let me know on Twitter. I'm at Phil Moore. And a special thanks to my friend Jeff, who's animatic on SoundCloud, for the opening and closing. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.